Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Mondays usually begin with national politics for us. We're changing that up a bit this week. NPR plans to simulcast the CNN New York Times presidential debate tomorrow at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which you can hear right here on Cap Radio. And we're also planning a special live half-hour pre-debate show that will start at 4:30. The political junkie Ken Rudin will join me from the Washington, D.C. area. Sac State Professor of Debate Kristen Tudor will join me in the studio. So again, I hope you'll join us for that. That's tomorrow at 4:30, just before NPR broadcasts the presidential debate live, and that starts at 5. Now we're going to shift to the fires which erupted over the weekend, mainly in Southern California. There were a few in the north, though, too. And the ongoing controversy over PG&E's power shutoffs last week. Joining me from KQED is Lily Jamali. She is co-host of the California Report. Hi, Lily. Thanks for making time today.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me.
Tell me how the past few days have been for you.
You know, it's been an illuminating couple of days. In my role here at the California Report, I get to, in the same day, talk to Governor Newsom and also talk to someone who is, say, sitting in their car in a parking lot at 9 o'clock at night because their power is out. So I've learned a lot. I've gotten to talk to so many different people and try to understand the impacts, the burden that these shutoffs have left on customers, on ratepayers, on everyday Californians, and also try to hold government officials to account. So it's been, as I say, illuminating. I've learned so much.
In the first day or so of the power shutoffs, one official put it to me, I wonder whether PG&E is being too protective or did they get it just right? And now there's a consensus on which answer is the more prevalent. But tell me from your view what people were telling you as this went on about, is this the right balance? Is that the right protection? And then the outrage that followed about the decision.
Well, Beth, I've heard really the full range of opinions. Before the shutoffs actually took place, as we were preparing for them, PG&E had tried to give some notice that these were coming early in the week. I talked to mayors and people who had lost their fires and homes, their homes and fires, rather, that were caused by PG&E equipment. And I was surprised by sort of the understanding that, for example, somebody who lost their home in Paradise might exhibit when talking about this. You know, they know that this is very inconvenient, but I think that there is that what if question for people in that category. What if they had shut off the power in the hours before the campfire? So that question looms large for people who have really lost everything as a result of these fires these last few years. I also got to speak to, for example, the mayor of Union City, which is a city of about 75,000 people here in the Bay Area. And she, too, was very understanding and said, you know, this is something that we have to do. Even Governor Newsom echoed that sentiment that this is really the best option that we have. But to your other point, I think the question now is really, was PG&E, not conservative enough in the way that they applied these outages? Did they almost play it too safe at the expense of customers who had to watch, you know, their groceries rot or maybe had to lose hours at work or pay extra in childcare expenses because we had, you know, 130,000 kids out of school for at least one day last week? Mm. We might never know if it's true. We can't prove that they prevented a fire by doing these shutoffs on the scale, on the vast scale that they ended up doing this with. But what we do know is that there was no fire. So that debate is going to continue in the days and months to come because we know that this is going to be a tool that PG&E relies on going forward. They've said as much in the last couple of days.
So I'm sure you saw the New York Times story published on Saturday because a headline from that story has been printed far and wide. Elizaveta Malashenko is a representative for the California Public Utilities Commission, and the PUC was in the control room with PG&E over the time of the shutoffs. And her quote was, "There were definitely missteps. It's pretty much safe in saying this did not go well."
What kind of conversation did you have, if any, with PG&E along the way over the progression of days?
Well, I talked to members of their communications department multiple times every day last week. And then we also had an opportunity to hear from the CEO of the company, who we haven't heard a lot from since he took office. I think it was in May or June of this year. Really the only time I had ever heard his voice before this this incident was at their annual general shareholders meeting, which took place here in San Francisco in June. And it's been pretty quiet. I mean, he's been trying to orient himself, but we had him come out and talk during the news conferences that they had, not the first one, but I think it was the last two, where we heard him apologize, you know, express regret for the way that the execution went on these shutoffs. The problem was, it was not that, you know, people question whether this is something that can stop wildfires. And in fact, you know, we've been seeing over the last weekend the members of the PG&E communications department tweeting, for example, photos of vegetation that ended up landing on wires. We know that there were 50 instances of that, possibly even more, as many as 100 more examples. And the point being, you know, these are things that could have caused a fire. They want people to see that. But I think that people were a little bit taken aback by some of the statements that the PG&E CEO made, even as he apologized for the issues that we saw with the website, where, you know, this is the resource that people are most inclined to look at if they know that a shutoff is coming, and they can't even access basic information about where the shutoffs are happening, how many people are affected. So a lot of that information ended up coming from the news media, really us, you know, trying to serve as the intermediary to tell people where to go, helping them with maps because PG&E's site was down. They also had issues, for example, with their call center, where I think there was just a staffing issue there. And so a lot of people who were calling were not able to get through. But back to what the PG&E CEO said, you know, I was kind of intrigued by the last statement that he made on Saturday during a news conference, where he tried to outline what he sees as misconceptions about what happened here. And he said, you know, one of the main storylines is that we did this to save our own skin. And he said, I can't fathom that. We did this for the safety of others. And misconception number two that he outlined is our system is in shambles. He said that they'd spent the last 9 months doing accelerated inspections, that they'd found a lot of problems, and it's simply not true that the condition of the system was what caused these power shutoffs. I think if you asked Governor Gavin Newsom about this, he would give you a very different answer. He spoke on Thursday and said that this shutoff situation is really the product of neglect. And a lot of critics echo that. They say that this is the product of short-term, you know, the desire for short-term returns being prioritized over many, many years, decades, being prioritized over long-term investment in the system. And that conversation kind of leads you to this debate over, does the investor-owned utility model, which PG&E is what we call an IOU, an investor-owned utility, mm-hmm. does that model make sense? You know, you guys in Sacramento have SMUD, which right. is often held up as a model for how a utility should be run. This is a municipal utility, which is actually part of the PG&E system way back in the day, and broke off. It took them a long time, but, you know, SMUD did not have anything like what we saw out here in the Bay Area and other parts of the Sierra foothills that are dependent on PG&E for their power.
So a couple questions out of all of what you just said. We should mention that PG&E rejected a bid from San Francisco to buy the utility. And that was on San Francisco territory. Also, there is the political side to this. You referenced the governor. So let's start with that issue of the buying of PG&E and the rejected bid.
Yeah. So on Friday, PG&E issued was reported on Friday. The actual letter was sent to Mayor London Breed of San Francisco on October 7th. And what PG&E basically says in outlining the reasons why they don't want San Francisco to buy PG&E's grid on their territory is that San Francisco is underestimating the cost of PG&E's equipment. You know, having done a lot of of business reporting over the years, it's clear to me that valuation, when you try to put a price tag on a system like this or a product or a company, it's really more art than science. And so the number that San Francisco came up with was $2.5 billion. That's what they are offering PG&E here. And PG&E said, you know, our assets are not for sale. They also pointed out, and I think that there is an interesting argument here that even critics of PG&E might find compelling, is that customers outside of San Francisco who are dependent on PG&E could see their rates rise because of this. So if you think about it, you know, it's a lot cheaper to service a customer in a place like San Francisco than it is in a place like Paradise, because you have San Francisco being a high density, low cost environment. You have a lot of people there, whereas in a rural community like Paradise, it costs more to get that power out to that single customer in a place like that. Mm-hmm. So this becomes an issue of equity. You know, what is the cost? How do we treat rural customers who are getting an opportunity to have service? Because, you know, when you look at economies of scale, to use a financial term, because PG&E can do it a lot cheaper, and so they kind of front end the cost and invest that savings towards powering other parts of the grid that are more far flung.
So finally, to the politics question, and I know you asked the governor directly about this, didn't you?
I did. I asked him, how is this allowed to stand? Which I know is sort of a charged question, but it's not that I don't understand the rationale, but I thought it was important that we, you know, pose that question to the governor of this state. We've seen governors fall on the issue of energy in the past, see Gray Davis. Right. And I thought it was an important question to pose to him, because, you know, nobody wants to see more fires caused by PG&E equipment. The governor responded to me by saying that this has become the industry standard, these shutoffs. And he brought up the case of San Diego Gas and Electric, which is often credited for having piloted these shutoffs. But the difference there, and I may have pointed this out to the governor as he was elaborating, I said, but that is a smaller population on a much smaller territory. And so then we come back to that debate that we were having a moment ago about, you know, is PG&E taking a playbook that might have worked for a place that's smaller, that serves fewer people, and applied it in a way that was not appropriate, using these shutoffs as a blunt tool that ended up maybe affecting way more customers than really needed to be.
All right, Lily, thank you for the scope of your reporting. I think we'll link a few of your reports so people can continue to do more of their reading on their own. I appreciate you joining us this morning and adding so much to the conversation, which, as I said, is going to go on for a long time beyond the next incident. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Beth. It's really great to be on with you. I appreciate it.
That is Lily Jamali, co-host of the California Report based at KQED. Now joining us by phone is CAL FIRE Deputy Chief Scott McClain. Hi, Deputy Chief McClain. Glad to have you back on Insight with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We just had some conversation about vegetation that landed on fire lines but didn't cause fires. What's the CAL FIRE assessment of what did and didn't happen related to the power shutoffs?
Well, related to the power shutoff, it's hard to say, honestly. I mean, we don't have any stats. We don't have anything concrete as of yet. We did respond as we do. On average, think about it. It's about 170 to 200 wildfires a week that throughout the state that we respond to. Over the last few days, we've definitely had over 60 wildfire starts. So we're still staying within that average, if not a little bit more.
So how about an update on the Los Angeles Saddle Ridge fire?
Sure. The Sandalwood, which is down in Riverside out of Cala Mesa, is, as of this morning, 1,011 acres, 94% contained. So they're getting a real good handle on it. They still have to go around and, unfortunately, do all the structures that did catch on fire, making sure that those are mitigated, as well as doing some patrols. So evacuations in some areas, especially around that trailer park that was so devastated, remain in place. The Saddle Ridge fire in L.A. County, that was a combination of L.A. County, L.A. City, and the Angeles National Forest, is at 7,965 acres and 43% contained. as you can imagine, there's still a lot of work, especially where this fire went into, to make sure that they fully contain it, and it will take a little bit of time.
In the case of Saddle Ridge, is there an ongoing investigation that an electrical tower might have been the ignition point?
As far as that, I am not aware of. This is not within our jurisdiction. We're definitely there to help. So it will be an ongoing investigation, and once they have those findings, they'll either decide whether to give it to the district attorney, or if there is no fault found, then they'll release the cost.
Is there a gauge or an estimation at this point about the number of the fires you just mentioned having been related to the winds last week, either the north winds in the north or the Santa Anas in the south?
Well, yes. I mean, we saw, it started basically a week ago yesterday. The American fire was one prime example I've been using up out of Napa County. It blew, and it was wind-driven, it blew over 500 acres in just a matter of a couple hours. You saw what happened, unfortunately, down south with the Santa Anas with those winds. It pushed those major fires and several smaller ones that were able to be caught very quickly. Then you have the fires that, we have that one in Mariposa, that's a Briceburg fire, and it's up to 5,563 acres, but it was burning in such steep, horrific terrain that it was very hard to get access to. It didn't really get much effect from the weather patterns that we saw up north versus down south. It was kind of right in the middle, so it made its own weather, but definitely not as dramatic as the situations we had to deal with latter part of last week down south.
The Caples Fire is in the El Dorado National Forest, so
right.
I understand that might be a U.S. Forest Service fire. Is CAL FIRE assisting with that one?
We did, right, when it broke out, we were requested. Keep in mind that there's a master mutual aid system in the state of California that works pretty good. You've got a little under 1,000 different fire services in the state. We all have been trained the same. We all have the same type of radio communications. CAL FIRE moved some of our resources around, for an example, in the North State earlier in the last week of 20 fire engines, and I think it was 9 hand crews pre-positioned up north. As the winds subsided up there, resources started rolling down to the south in preparation and additional resources to be involved in those fires. So the Forest Service is definitely involved in that, so yes.
I'm talking with CAL FIRE Deputy Chief Scott McLean. I understand that that fire in particular, the Caples Fire, started as a prescribed burn on or around September 30th and then jumped to a classification of wildfire when it somehow exceeded its controlled boundaries. Can you explain any more about that?
From what I understand, due to the weather conditions, they did do that, yes, but it is still within their boundaries as far as prescribed burn. I believe it was supposed to be about 8,800 acres eventually. When it was completed, or is going to be completed. So it stayed within the boundaries, and it's just over 2,800 acres right now.
So that's the one that filled the Sacramento Valley and the Tahoe Basin area with smoky air over the weekend.
That is correct.
Any insight into the decision to do a prescribed burn late in September, for example, as opposed to later in the year or at a time when a lot of people happen to be out and about for either fall vacations or fall colors, fall hiking, whatever it might be?
Mm-hmm. I can't speak for the Forest Service on this particular fire. I can talk to you about, you know, the prescribed burns and mechanical fuel reductions that we do. We are doing a few this week because it's conducive to do so. One is going to be taking place in Butte County, as a matter of fact, along Lake Oroville. So again, the weather conditions are right. We'll have our resources there to get it done. It will be a prescribed burn, low-intensity burn. So, again, the weather plays a big factor, especially with the winds. And, you know, a little bit of a breeze to blow that smoke out, too.
Okay, let's do a little public service. A few more details about that prescribed burn in Butte County, would you please?
Sure. It's, we have been trying to do one in that particular area for a while. And now it looks like that it's called the Loafer Creek burn, and it looks like the weather's going to be conducive. Now, you know, it's going to come down to that morning of the burn to verify if it's a go or no-go situation. So it's a cooperative effort between CAL FIRE Butte County Fire and the California Department of Water Resources and the California Department of Parks and Rec. So we're all involved in this type of situation. Now, keep in mind, too, that the 45-day plan that we were tasked with putting together early this year per the governor, we picked out 35 of our projects and made them a priority. And we're aggressively continuing to make sure that we get those situations mitigated, which actually affect almost a little over 200 communities in a good way. So that's either prescribed burn or mechanical fuel reduction projects.
What morning right now is that prescribed burn planned for? And could there be power shutoffs related to a prescribed burn?
No, that's a good question. It's going to take place, if it meets all the criteria, tomorrow morning. And as far as the only time we would ask for a power shutoff is when we're fighting a wildfire and the power lines are going through that fire area. For our safety, we'll ask for those power lines to be shut down. I've seen it where it's been a heavy, smoky condition underneath power lines, and the however you describe it, the power lines grounded through those smoke particles to the ground, and it's not a good place to be at the time. So that's one of the reasons we do shut those down, or request them to be.
All right. Is there anything else we should know in terms of any other major wildfires burning right now? There had been one that, again, was being fought on national forest land, I believe, in the Yosemite area. We've got one up by Lassen. So what are the alerts on any other places of the battle?
Right now, well, let's back up a little bit. September and October, historically, are the worst 2 months in the state of California for wildfires. Except for if we look at 2017 and 18, unfortunately. But so we still have ways to go in this month. Reason being, in Northern California, you're getting that fall weather, you're having the winds, which are going to bring the humidities down, which is going to make that fuel still receptive, the vegetation, to fire. So we have that situation up north. Down south, we're dealing with the Santa Anas, which come this time of year as well. So we understand that. We watch the weather religiously, and then we prepare accordingly. So we ask the folks to continue to be, especially in the state of California, to be prepared. Readyforwildfire.org is a great website to look at on how to be prepared, what to do in case of, what to do during, and what to do after a wildfire. And you can roll it over to different things such as power outages as well.
All right, Scott, thanks so much for the time this morning. I appreciate that and the information about the Loafer Creek possibility tomorrow.
Thank you.
That is CAL FIRE Deputy Chief Scott McLean. One more person to check in with today, and that is Brian May from the California Office of Emergency Services. Brian is the office's public information officer, and that was really the brain center for the fires, the power shutoffs, the related situations. So hi, Brian. Glad to have you back on the air.
Good morning, Beth. How are you?
Last Thursday when we talked, there was not yet an emergency situation. So much unfolded after that. What's the view of what happened from the Cal OES perspective?
Well, it was a chance for us to once again put into practice what we work on and practice for year-round, and that was the potential for very large wildfires. We saw massive evacuations. And as a state, it was up to us to respond to that in a very appropriate and quick manner. Our question always is, what are the unmet needs? We had shelters that were opened up very quickly throughout the LA area, throughout the counties that were affected. And now that we can hopefully get these behind us and get back to life as normal for those residents that had to evacuate.
At this point, what can you say about what could have and should have been done differently? And I don't mean just you, but the Cal OES perspective, including the governor's office.
Well, you know, from our standpoint, it's a matter of anticipating what's going to happen in the emergency world and responding to that proactively. So we knew that these fire conditions were coming up. We pre-positioned firefighters all across the state, and we saw those pre-positioned firefighters and equipment come into play. There was a small fire that started in Moraga before this past weekend, and they were able to jump on that very quickly. It was close to homes. They were able to knock that down. We had about 60 teams that were pre-positioned across the state. And so from a statewide standpoint, as far as emergency management is concerned, we want to anticipate with these wind conditions that were coming up. We knew they were going to be bad. We were proactive in that, and it helped us knock them down quick.
It looks, Brian, from the language in the governor's declaration of a state of emergency, which was released on Friday, that the wind event was the setup, but it was really the outbreak of the Saddle Ridge fire, the Southern California fires, And what I'm getting to here is a question that I asked you last Thursday. Would the power shutoffs alone have been the reason, ultimately, as the days went on, for a state of emergency to be declared?
Well, the state of emergency really is a funding mechanism that helps the affected counties keep firefighters on the clock without having to worry about any kind of payroll or any kind of financial obligation. So if there hadn't been the fire that happened because of that, we still would have had people without power. You may have had some shelters that were opened up. But the state of emergency mainly speaks to, let's not let any bureaucratic red tape get in the way of fighting these fires and making sure we have the people on staff.
What happens now in the conversation with all stakeholders about the decision that was made by PG&E and what might be put in place for the next time?
Well, we're going to use every incident as a learning opportunity. I'm sure PG&E will have some after-action reports. We as a state, anytime that we are activated, we'll look at this and have after-action reports, make sure that what lessons have we learned, did we make any mistakes, were there any vulnerabilities that this emergency exposed, and we tend to see that in every emergency. It exposes some kind of weakness, and that's immediately what we'll work on. So there will be discussions both within PG&E, I'm sure, although I'm not going to speak for them, but I would suspect there'll be internal discussions with them. And certainly for us on the state level, we'll get back together and say, what could we have done better and quicker?
And how much influence can be exerted from the state level to PG&E for a change before the next time?
I'm sure that's a discussion that the governor will continue to have with them.
Okay, Brian, I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Beth.
That is Brian May. He is PIO for the California Office of Emergency Services. So we covered a lot of ground this morning. There is quite a bit of reporting on our website, including a number of maps. And the CAL FIRE incident map is a good one to stay tuned to watch for the fires that are burning in the state and throughout fire season. We'll post all of those links at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.